Welcome to everyone listening all around the world, all across the United States. We're coming to you live right here from the Coast to Coast AM World Headquarters right here in Los Angeles, California. This is Jimmy Church sitting in for George, who is, taking one of those nights off. He'll be back on Monday with his guests Peter Ward and Brooks Agnew. We've got a really great show lined up tonight because I've been gone for a couple of weeks. I'm out there working, doing my thing, but I'm back and I'm excited. I'm here, right here in George's studio. But two very interesting things happened over the last couple of weeks while I was gone. And in the world of astronomy and physics, it was just crazy news. First, it was the announcement out of Caltech that astronomer Mike Brown and his team may have actually found the ninth planet, or 10th, depending on, who's counting. Certainly, Mike Brown counts in that. And then yesterday, the potentially huge discovery of gravity waves. Yes, the ones that Albert Einstein referred to in his general relativity. Two very important subjects for one man and his team as well. And that man is Walter Cruttenden, and the team is the Binary Research Institute. Tonight, we have Walter here on Coast to Coast. He is a theoretical archaeoastronomer, and we're going to discuss both the new planet, the ninth planet or tenth planet, the illustrious one that nobody thought was out there planet, and, it's lying beyond Pluto somewhere, as well as what may be the most important discovery of this century, gravity waves, and his theory that our solar system could be orbiting around a second or binary star. Walter is one of the brightest and the best out there, and we have him here on Coast to Coast tonight. And the great news, it's Friday, and you know what that means. I get to hear from all of you. We'll follow Walter with open lines, and all of that is next on Coast to Coast AM. Filling in for George, I'm Jimmy Church. We're going to get straight to Walter Cruttenden right after this short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host for the evening, sitting in for George as he is away, and he'll be back on Monday. My guest tonight is Walter Cruttenden. Now, before I get to Walter, you know the rules. The rules are follow me on Twitter right now, at JChurchRadio. Twitter is live to my left. If you want to participate in real time during the show tonight, just right there, hit me in Twitter, hashtag F2B, and I will see everything in real time. Any questions, any comments on the show, it is interactive, and I do watch, and that is at JChurchRadio. All right, it's Open Lines Friday. But we had to bring Walter Cruttenden on because a couple of weeks ago, with the discovery of the potential discovery of the ninth planet, I immediately reached out to the one person that that I needed to hear from, and that was Walter. Brought him over on my show and had a great conversation. But we didn't anticipate what happened yesterday either. And immediately, Walter needed to be on this show tonight. Walter Cruttenden is the director of the Binary Research Institute in Newport Beach, California, where he researches the cause and the consequences of solar system motion. Walter is also the host of the annual conference on precession and ancient knowledge. It's called CPAC, which brings together authors and scientists from around the world discussing the implications of the precession cycle on biology, archaeology, anthropology, and related sciences. I would like to welcome back to Coast our good friend, Walter Cruttenden. Walter, good evening. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jimmy. How about you?
Not as excited as you are. Pretty amazing times this past couple of weeks.
It really is. Yeah, two huge discoveries within a month of each other. Yeah, just amazing.
You must be giddy. That's the first thing, because you've been working on this for over 10 years. You've been shouting and presenting research and CPAC, and which is, it's all great. But then you start to get this verification of everything that you've been talking about. Pretty exciting.
It really is. Yeah. You start to think maybe you're not crazy after all. But yeah, no, the emails are coming from a lot of places. You know, people I've first started talking to this about 10 years ago, and now, you know, people are filling in the pieces, and it's great. You know, it started with this thought that there's this big gravitational mass out there, but you know, the initial thought was it really couldn't be, you know, anything that we could find or see, because we know everything about the solar system. It's almost funny how science always takes this very conservative approach at first. And then, you know, the more they realized that all these minor planets were starting to line up in this pattern, the more they were forced to, you know, admit that something very big is out there and it's affecting our solar system.
And one of the things, and this is what I want to do really quick, Walter, as we lead into the first break. Let's do this first. All of this is something that you have been talking about a long time, which is gravity affects everything. It doesn't really matter about distance. There are things going on here, and we need to talk about it. And then Mike Brown hits us with Caltech 2 weeks ago with the potential discovery of the ninth planet, which he had to do because he had to replace Pluto with something, right? So he was able to detect a large body out there that was affecting lots of things in our solar system. And how important is that discovery, and what was the discovery?
Well, it's particularly important, and I think it got more attention because it was Mike Brown that was shouting about it this time. And you remember Mike, who's, you know, brilliant astrophysicist, was the guy that had been finding many of these minor planets out there, including Sedna. And so when he found many planets that started to be and look a lot like Pluto, the realization came that, boy, these are, you know, much smaller than the regular classic planets. Maybe Pluto has been misclassified all these years, and therefore maybe we should have a big meeting of all the astrophysicists and sort of get this question straight once and for all. And so we all remember, you know, less than 10 years ago, Pluto was sort of kicked out. It was no longer nine planets in our solar system, just eight. And I understand that Mike's daughter was mad at him for that. And so he kept looking and looking and finding more minor planets. But then he realized that all these minor planets he's been finding kind of line up in a very unusual pattern.
And how so? How
well,
so?
Well, he calls it a gravitational signature. And that is that if you think of the eight classical planets, they're all within 1 or 2 degrees of the plane of the solar system. And when Pluto came along, it was discovered it's about 17 degrees inclined to the plane. And that so that was strange. And then also it was noticed after a while that its orbit is much more elliptical. You know, there's very little eccentricity in the eight big planets, but Pluto has this huge eccentricity. It's this stretched oval. And so when he kept finding these other minor planets, they kind of all fit into that pattern. So it seems that the farther out you go and the smaller the planet you're observing, the more it appears to be affected by something on one side of the solar system. And, you know, it just, the evidence mounted and mounted and mounted, and I think they were looking unofficially, you know, probably for the last 2 years, but having found nothing, they've kind of opened it up to the world now, because, you know, the U.S. Astronomers, astrophysicists are sort of in a race with the rest of the world, because the Spanish astrophysicists came out and said something similar. But it was really Caltech, Mike and his team, that added much more detail to the whole idea that there has to be a big gravitational influence out there.
And then you had Percival Lowell, when he was looking for the ninth or possibly a tenth, and Pluto comes along, he said, you know, Pluto's just too small to be causing these issues that we see out there. Pluto's fine, and that's cool. But there's got to be something else. Pluto is not big enough to cause these distractions that are going on out there. And then Mike Brown hits this 2 weeks ago, and it does seem to fit, you know, all of the questions that have been on the table.
Yeah, and so you make a good point that when Pluto was first discovered, there was a lot of talk and chatter about there must be something bigger. And then we didn't find anything for a while, so it just died down. And then, of course, our telescopes got stronger, our computers got better, and Mike and his team in the modern era, you know, were able to find many more things, including to find that the Kuiper Belt sort of seems to have a sheer edge to it. So there's, you know, there's multiple items that point to a large gravitational object out there, and I think we're just finally accepting those in mainstream astronomy, if you will.
When do you think we're going to have some, you know, definitive proof, either through physical proof, through a telescope, but maybe imaging?
So the race is on.
I mean, sure.
You know, at first it was just the Spanish and Caltech and a few other people that read the research that, you know, had access to large scopes that would be looking. But now that this is, you know, publicly acknowledged, you know, in news and Nature and all the top publications, there's probably 1,000 different astronomers, astrophysicists, diligently looking for it. I mean, some of them still have to book telescope time, but and they're looking in, you know, various parts of the sky, although generally on just one side of the solar system.
I got a ton of email after you and I spoke last week or the week before, saying the obvious, and this is the general public, Walter, saying the obvious. What about Kepler? What about Hubble? We can see everything else at vast distances. What's going on here? Why can't we simply just point these two telescopes there? Because this is relatively close compared to the rest of the Milky Way and everything else.
Right. Well, I'm pretty much in that camp, by the way. But there is a legitimate reason why things would be difficult to see. And, you know, one is it could be a very cold object, you know, almost a planet-like mass, and therefore just not showing up very well, particularly if it's covered with dust, not reflecting light. Or it could be an object, you know, hidden with the sort of the glare of the Milky Way. Or it's possible, you know, that we just haven't tracked that part of the sky for long enough. But the longer this goes on, the weaker those excuses become.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's what kind of gets back to our original hypothesis, which, yes, there's a big gravitational influence, and yes, it's stretching our solar system. But no, it's not a planet, and I don't think they're going to find a planet anytime within the next couple of years. And that will then lead to, well, the influence is still there. What else could be causing it?
And then what about, here's the elephant in the room for all of our coast-to-coast audience and the readers of The 12th Planet and the fans of Sitchin's work. Is this what Sitchin was talking about?
Well, you know, I think there's different interpretations there. Sitchin, you know, he not only looked at some of the modern astronomy, but he also looked at very ancient texts and mythology. And I think that some of what he's interpreting could have slightly different interpretations. And, you know, I don't want to cause any uproar or anything, but just even the word Nibiru has been interpreted differently by different people. So, you know, hats off to Sitchin for putting the argument forward, getting a lot of people thinking about it, talking about an object. But I don't think that the, you know, the periodicity of the orbit fits very well with what he's talking about. And so I look to, you know, a different explanation using some of the same data.
Where did Mike Brown, and I'm sure you've looked at his data, where did Mike Brown get his orbit time and sequence from those calculations? Because it isn't that a 10,000 to 20,000 year orbit? That's a pretty wide band of numbers. Have you had a chance to look at that data?
Yeah, and the longer they look at it, the more they can narrow it down. And I think it's pushing more and more towards the upper limit as time goes on. But remember, you have to look at more than just a few arc seconds or even few arc minutes to start to understand the ellipse. And so that's effectively what they're doing, is they need to watch it long enough to determine the orbit periodicity.
Well, we have a paradox here, at least with me, which is I want it to be a 20,000-year orbit. I want it swinging by here every 10,000 years, because then we really get to get crazy with questions and answers. If it is a 10,000-year orbit and we're looking at it swinging by here every 5,000 years on the far side of our sun and solar system, It's cool, but I don't think it has the historical impact of a 10,000-year cycle coming through and affecting gravity. For me, you have precession and a bunch of other things that happen cyclically at that 10,000-year cycle. And although those, it seems like a reach, I think it's a strange coincidence.
Yeah. So you know my feelings on it. I think it's going to be towards the upper limit, even a little bit beyond, because it fits the precession data and other data so well. And in fact, you know, this whole concept of time that we use nowadays, with two 12-hour periods that adds up to a total of 24, is a very, very ancient idea. We can only trace it as far back as the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians, but really nobody knows where it came from before that. It fits very well with some ancient Indian data too, in the laws of Manu. But anyway, it would appear that, you know, if it's 12,000 years out and 12,000 years back, a cycle of 24,000 years, then it fits the precession data very nicely, and it suggests that our current concept of time is actually a microcosm of this great year, if you will. And that has a lot of significance.
It's a whole nother class of and degree in college if it does open up those doors, if you think about it. And the implications of the binary system, a binary star system for us, is there a possibility that this could be a brown dwarf or a gaseous giant that could have been another star here at one time and got cut loose out of the solar system for whatever reason?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, if it's a brown dwarf or a star, you would still call that a binary system. Yes, it could have definitely been closer at one time. And so there's this whole field of research going on that, you know, it's a planet or a very small star, and we just haven't seen it yet. And I think that's the most logical or the easiest thing for mainstream science to accept right now. But again, to me, if you pull in even more data, you know, the unexplained forces acting on the space probes and the precession data, et cetera, then I think you want to find one solution for all that. The fact that our whole system is curving through space would say that, you know, we're in a binary system, and it must be a pretty significant mass to essentially stretch the minor planets out in such wide orbits.
This is some of the most exciting times I've ever been in. I never would have anticipated something like this in our lifetime. You know, this has been a really crazy roller coaster a couple of weeks when it comes to physics and astronomy. And we're going to be heading towards a break. What I would like, really quick, what is a binary star system and why is it so important?
Well, good point. Yeah, some of the basics. So,
yes,
a binary star system is two stars gravitationally bound orbiting a common center of mass, and that center will be closer to the largest mass. And, you know, 50-100 years ago, it was thought that these things are pretty rare, and then as telescopes got better, people realized, oh boy, they're all over the place. And it has gone, just in my lifetime, from about an estimate of 50% of all stars being binary, now up to 80% of all stars being binary.
And why would it be, why would it make us so unique? I understand that we would be 10% of everything, but are we truly unique if we don't have that binary star?
I think we are. I think stars like companions as much as people do.
Walter Cruttenton, director of the Binary Research Institute, Newport Beach, California, is our guest tonight. And when we come back after the break, the big news, gravity waves. Albert Einstein was right. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, and we'll be back right after this. All right. One of the great things about doing this show is this is late night talk radio. And that's all I used to do growing up, listening to shows like this, just thinking one day. One day, I'm going to be able to, just one day. And now, I get to do that. I get to paint that picture for you. Right now, we are in the studio here in Los Angeles. The lights are turned down. It's dark. That's what you need to do. Turn down the lights and then enjoy that bumper music because I get to choose it and just paint that picture for you. Two very interesting things have happened over the last couple of weeks. Yesterday, one of the biggies, gravity waves discovered. Albert Einstein referred to this in his general relativity. We're going to be talking about that more with Walter Cruttenton right after the break. And then next week, come and meet George, Tom, myself at the 14th annual Conscious Life Expo. It's right here in Los Angeles at the LAX Hilton. It's going on February 19th through the 21st, right here in Los Angeles. Just go right now to ConsciousLifeExpo.com. Get yourself some tickets. Get the video live streaming. Come and visit us. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. More with Walter Cruttenton right after this short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast to Coast AM. Walter Cruttenton is the director of the Binary Research Institute right here in Newport Beach, California. And we're discussing the recent astronomy and physics discoveries over the last 2 weeks. And yesterday, the big announcement came, gravitational waves. Walter, let's go straight there. The first question I have, if everything adds up and everything is correct, could ET ride these waves and get here to Earth?
I don't know. Is he out there?
It's the obvious question, right? And is this something that we could use to go there?
Boy, I'm just elated because it gives us a different way to look at the universe. You know, we've had optical waves, you know, through telescopes, visible light for, you know, a couple hundred years. Just really gotten good in the last few decades. And then X-ray telescopes and radio telescopes, but all those are using the electromagnetic spectrum. And so what's unique here is we now are effectively have a way to see things with gravitational waves. And so it just as X-rays and radio telescopes gave you, you know, a new view. You didn't just see the visible light of, you know, a few stars scattered amongst a mostly black sky. You saw, you know, massive auroras and a much more active and violent sky. I'm imagining that, you know, using the lens of gravitational waves, we'll be able to see things that we didn't know existed. And I'm not sure what they are, but it probably, you know, you're going to see different ways of looking at the universe, different structures that we can hardly imagine.
Well, the LIGO discovery, which the announcement came yesterday, and when I looked at their numbers and the graphs that they presented and the description of it, I had a hard time wrapping my brain around. I thought I was going to go, okay, I get it. I understand. But these are very, very small measurements that actually did come in waves. Can you describe that to the audience so they understand how they made sense out of this and actually observed a wave?
I'll do my best. So they use basically light and mirrors, interferometer, to measure, you know, over a distance. And then they compare them to each other. And if there's a difference in them, And they have them at completely different ends of the U.S. You know, one's in Louisiana, one's up in Washington State. That it means, and yet they get the same sort of signal in each one. It means that something has effectively passed through the Earth and slightly thrown off this measurement of, you know, the speed of light, effectively, in two different locations. Now, I happen to think that there's an easier way to do the experiment, and it's probably, you know, it's probably hubris on my part, but I ran into a guy in Canada a decade or so ago, a brilliant man, Karl-Heinz Hohmann. He had the Sirius Research Group, and he had something in his basement for over 20 years, and that was a fixed telescope, you know, in cement, always pointed out the window towards Sirius, which is pretty low in the sky from Canada. And the telescope had dust on it because, you know, just didn't want to ever touch it. And then right next to the telescope, he had a radio with the atomic time from Fort Collins that would give you a beep, you know, every X seconds. And then the telescope had a crosshair on it. And so it was pointed towards Sirius. So if you think about it, it's fixed on the Earth, but the Earth is spinning. So every sidereal day, you know, every 23 hours, 56 minutes and 4 seconds, Sirius would come around. And so I remember being at his house and we're having tea and he says, "Oh, Sirius is about to come around. I want you to take a look." And sure enough, it's going through the crosshairs and he's measuring the time exactly. And what he found was that the Earth spins at a very even rate, except when our nearest one of our nearest binary systems, certainly our largest near binary system, the Sirius system, Sirius B goes around Sirius A. And when that comes in between, the Earth actually slowed down for about a second the day before it passed, a couple days, and then it sped up that second in the next couple of days. And so it's a different way of doing a similar experiment, and that is he was using the entire Earth and rather simple equipment, and then he didn't even know to expect this. It just so happened that, you know, Sirius B going around Sirius A,
right,
it happens every 50, it's a 50-year orbit, and it happened during his measurement time, and that's when he noticed, and he started to look at the literature and found out that something similar had been discovered last time it went, it happened. So I think it's, you know, it's just a cool way of measuring gravity waves, which when Karl-Heinz was doing it were thought not to exist.
And what's interesting here for me, Walter, is all of this back in the early 1900s when Albert was putting this together, it was math. It was in his brain. It was in his mind. And he proved it, or got the theory going in general relativity that gravity waves existed. But again, it was in one man's mind and it was presented in math, and that they had to be there. And I find that totally fascinating. And for it to actually happen as it was presented in one man's mind and theory and presented to the scientific community, here we are, 100 years later, boom, it actually proved to be, you know, not only real, but happening.
No question. I mean, the guy is one of the greatest scientists that ever lived, absolutely brilliant. And he could see these things in his mind. And he could speak this unique language of math. And he's a pretty good mathematician, I hear.
Yeah, right.
And so he could communicate it to the astrophysical community. And even at the time, there were very few people that understood it. But as years passed, you know, more and more people began to understand the implications. And of course, it was a totally new way of looking at gravity, you know.
And I want to understand, too, as well, because I've seen I've seen the illustrations. I've seen some animations about this. But can we paint this picture for the audience, if you will, Walter? Is it like a wave of water, and like a surfer would ride that wave? Is this what we can visualize? Does this help us to try to picture what's going on?
You know, if you remove one of the dimensions, it's easier to put your head around. So let's, and that's what they do in these pictures you see on TV. They, you know, have a rubber surface or a grid. And then obviously a big object like the sun would make a pretty good sized dent in that that plane of space, if you will.
Right.
Whereas the Earth would make a smaller dent. And yes, as you know, when you look at it from a certain angle, it appears to be waves, especially anything orbiting a big mass. And so, you know, it's these sort of dents in space that space-time that are so, that is the way Albert put it, that was so different. Whether or not you can ride them, Jimmy, I mean, you're asking, that's a question that's probably a few hundred years out, but no doubt people will start thinking about that.
What's funny is, Walter, I get phone calls every single night from my audience that want to know or have their own ideas about gravity. And then I have PhDs that I talk to and physicists, and I never get a straight answer. It's a fascinating subject. I don't think they understand fully what gravity is. And to get 20 physicists in one room and astronomers to sit and discuss and try to, you know, come up with a definition that is accepted, I don't think it could happen. I think you would end up in a fist fight.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I think about your question, I'm trying to think of examples. And our planets are kind of riding gravity, if you will. You know, they're pulled in by the sun. And at the same time, there's another force. You know, they're moving so quickly around, they never get too close to the sun. And those forces are balanced, and they're sort of in this gravity track. They're the dent of their own mass that keeps them in place. And what we're, this new discovery we're talking about, this large gravitational influence on one side of our universe, is stretching planets, especially small distant planets, stretching them into these long elliptical orbits that are inclined to the plane. And so you can see that things are riding gravity. Gravity is sort of pulling and reshaping the solar system. It's just we haven't completely identified what this big gravitational mass is.
And we have a combination of different things. And help me on this. I just love talking to smart people. I always learn something. We have the gravity when you walk outside of your house and you drop a tennis ball and it hits the ground. We have that. We have gravity at the atomic level. We have the gravity that is keeping Earth in its position relative to the sun. We have the gravity that's keeping the moon out around our Earth, right? And it just keeps on going. And then we have the theory of gravitational waves moving through and also changing. And then we have the gravity that is affected out one more layer, like this additional planetary body. There are they all the same? The atomic level, what's keeping the water on planet Earth from spinning off into space, and then Earth around the sun and our solar system and its planets. It's very confusing.
It is confusing. And, you know, gravity is one of those things that you can measure pretty accurately. You know that it falls off with distance at a very measurable rate, but nobody knows exactly what causes it. We know it's related to mass, but you still don't know what causes it any more than we know what causes a magnet to pull. You know, we can again measure that falls off even faster than gravity. But nobody knows what causes that. And so I think we probably need to learn a little bit more before we can actually harness it. in my opinion.
And how does it affect us here? That's the big question. And I know this is something that you talk about quite a bit. If we have Planet Nine out on a 20,000 year orbit and its gravity affecting our solar system, obviously, and then we have gravity waves coming through, what does that mean to us? Why is it such an important discovery on both counts?
Well, you know, for me, I'm always interested in these cycles of time, cycles of history, and there's a couple of really obvious ones because they repeat so often relative to our lifespan. And the first one, of course, is the Earth spinning on its axis. So it spins, you know, we're all adapted to it. And so, you know, in a few hours, we'll all be in a subconscious state because our bodies are used to sleeping when there's not much of the electromagnetic spectrum being received from the sun. You know, it's dark. Versus when you get a lot of those rays, our bodies are adapted to awaken and be more active. Photosynthesis occurs. You know, it causes lots of stuff to happen, just that first celestial motion. And so there's another celestial motion that's even bigger, of course. That's the Earth revolving around the sun in 365 and a quarter days. And that, because the Earth's on a slight tilt, it causes, you know, more and less light. And so you go from, you know, spring with everything sort of blooming out of the ground to summer, it gives its fruit, and fall, it starts to fall off and wither, and winter, it appears to be dead, only for the light to reemerge and everything come back to life. And it's not only that. I mean, it's not only trillions of plant forms, but it's billions of other life forms that will spawn or migrate or hibernate in mass. And so those are just our first two celestial motions. They have dramatic effects on life, and yet we hardly even talk about it because it's so familiar to us. So if there is a third celestial motion, our entire solar system going around a big gravitational mass, which
right.
appears that there is,
right.
then it starts to lend a lot of credence to all these ancient stories about the rise and fall of civilization, something Plato called the Great Year, and something that, you know, Giorgio de Santillana, the former professor of the history of science at MIT, and
right.
Wrote about in Hamlet's Mill, that there are these cycles that come and go, alternating dark and golden ages, and over 30 ancient cultures talked about it. And so that's what fascinates me. Is that cycle just a long-lost myth that happens to be recurring in almost every single ancient culture, or does it really have a basis in fact? And I think we're right on the edge of science and understanding that it has a basis in fact.
Do you think this information is being suppressed?
I don't think it's suppressed so much, Jimmy, as it is, you know, these paradigms get to be so darn strong
mm-hmm.
that we ignore obvious stuff right in front of our face. Did you see the movie The Big Short by any chance?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I mean, fascinating thing, you know. And we're all buying into this idea that, you know, houses can only go up in value forever. And so everyone's buying this paper, which gets sketchier and sketchier and sketchier. And it's traded and it's all, blah, 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 blah. It's in all these portfolios. And next thing you know, everybody's dependent on this system and nobody wants to question it. And it's that way a little bit, and it's why it's so fun when great new discoveries like the ones in just the last few weeks, that there might be a ninth planet because there's got to be some big gravitational influence or gravity waves. And, you know, it's going to just open our eyes to something bigger.
It seems to me, Walter, that there's a big chunk of knowledge out there that somebody knows it's there and we're trying to get to it. You know, as we progress, as we grow older and as we mature, we are starting to question history and these gaps that are there in our knowledge. Where did the knowledge go? It didn't just disappear. It was certainly handed down through mythology and legend and teaching and mystery schools. And we get that today, but where did the knowledge go? Because 26,000 years ago and precession or longer, That knowledge of that came from somewhere. Somebody was taught it. Let's take some calls and discuss this, Walter. You want to hang out?
Great. Let's do it.
Let's do it. This is Coast to Coast AM. Our guest tonight is Walter Cruttenton. We're going to take your calls right after this. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Be right back.